¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Welcome to the symposium. Today we are joined by Dr. Benedict Beckelt and Dr. David Thunder. Hello to both.
Hello, good to be here.
I must say I'm very happy to be talking to you again. I remember we have done interviews separately, and I thought that it would be a very good idea if all of us had a discussion.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Our pleasure.
Great. So we are very pleased here at the Lotus Eaters to have both of you again, talking about things like the present state of Western societies, what is not working, what is working, what should be preserved, and whether there are grounds for optimism or pessimism. Of course, these are very abstract questions. I'm sure the answer will be very qualified. But let me just say that I think that it will going to be a very good discussion. May I ask both of you to tell to the audience where they can find more of your work, please?
If you like, I can begin. So my professional website is my name, davidthunder.com, David Thunder altogether, davidthunder.com. And I also have a blog, the Freedom Blog, which people can find at davidthunder.substack.com. So they're the two places they can find me.
Great. And
yeah, I had the same idea, myname.com, so benedictbeckelt.com, that's my website, and Benedict Beckelt is my handle pretty much everywhere, Twitter and Facebook and so on. So
that is great. So I think we should split our discussion in two sections. The first revolves around the question, where are we right now in Western societies, and several sub-questions that are related to it. And the second one is, where should we go? So I would basically like to moderate a discussion between the two of you. My goal is not to speak so much, but listen to what you are going to say and how you are going to interact with each other. So I would like to ask you, I think the first question is, what do you think are the main problems that Western societies face at the moment?
Do you want to begin again?
Sure. Okay, so Western societies, what are the problems facing Western societies? I think that the fundamental problem facing Western societies today is a cultural problem. More than an institutional problem, because I see institutional pathologies as very often derivative from cultural pathologies. And so I think that there's a declining understanding of basic concepts of a civil society, such as rule of law, freedom, equality, freedom of expression, constitutionalism. And I believe that these misunderstandings or this impoverished understanding was amply manifested during the pandemic in the readiness with which people accepted very severe restrictions of their liberties. So I guess I'll kick off the discussion by making the claim that there is a kind of cultural degradation that is happening in the West.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with that. And I think the cultural degradation, well, it's something, I think it's something we all share in common in our respective work, a discussion of that cultural degradation. And I think one sees this as a common theme of mine, but I think there are so many various indicators across the cultural board that this is in fact the case. You mentioned the civic aspect, and I think that's a big part of it, the decline in public education. People know less and less, and that's also part of an increase of a hyper egalitarianism, you might say. You mentioned equality or equality, I think, which is important, but we've gotten to the point where it has become so important that consideration, I think, has been allowed to crowd out everything else, the consideration of equality or egalitarianism, which degrades such things as public education, for example. Because if everyone if everyone is supposed to be equally educated, then the quality of public education will decrease. And I think we see that across the board, across public schools and across universities, certainly in this country, here in the United States, but in Europe as well. And so that contributes to it. People don't understand the roots of their own culture anymore, what has come before us, which leads to a decrease in gratitude, I would say, for what we have. And to taking it for granted, and that of course also I think contributes to a cheapening of our culture, because one doesn't really understand it anymore. And then of course, yeah, one there, that's one item. Whether it's the question of what's wrong with our society could be a long list, of course, but that's certainly one of them. Yeah.
Okay. So
might I just add to that just the problem of emotivism. The sense of being so caught up in our emotional responses to the world that we're not able to take a step back and take some distance from the immediate feelings that we're experiencing, the immediate things that are happening, to have even any sense of historical context, the sense of a bigger picture, the sense that we are on the shoulders of giants, the sense of what we do now will have consequences for future generations, and so on. And I think Alistair McIntyre, the philosopher Alistair McIntyre, underlines the problem of emotivism, and I would like to echo that I think there is an excessive kind of living within the emotional world in a way that is separated from rationality and objectivity.
Benedict.
Yeah, no, I was going to add, we're already now, building on what the other is saying. I was going to add that this emotivism that you mentioned, I think that's also an expression of the sort of hyper-individualism which goes along with hyper-egalitarianism, because if one does not understand the culture that has come before us, and that you said we're standing on the shoulders of giants and so on, if one doesn't understand that anymore, then one's own person becomes the sole social unit of importance. Nothing else matters. There is only the individual, and this sort of hyper-individualism, I think, is always indicative of declining cultures, and hyper-individualism, of course, will contribute to emotivism, because what we think and what we feel, what the individual person thinks and feels, becomes the only thing that matters. And so I think that all comes together. Yeah.
I wanted to add the notion of reason as one of the notions that are very much misunderstood. And a lot of the time, there is much more to it than just understanding it as an intellectual power. Because we could say that even if we go back to the pre-Socratics, the notion of reason, in a way, referred to a noble aspect of the soul that was also distinct from the emotions. And one of the traditional, we could say, cardinal virtues had to do with temperance, which was the control of emotions and the other aspects of the soul by reason, at least in thinkers like Plato. So it seems to me that the notion of reason has been misunderstood, as well as the other concept that you're mentioning. So it seems to me that one good area of research would have to be the intellectual, would concern the intellectual history of ideas with respect to these notions. But this is, of course, a very intellectual pursuit. So I would like to add that when people do not understand the notion of reason, and when we forget as a society the importance that reason is supposed to have, we cannot engage in public discussion anymore. And the institution of public discussion or the institution of rational debate gets completely eroded, because people are not willing enough to claim that we are not going to take it anymore. And we are going to have debates. And just because the feelings of some people are hurt from debates, that is not a reason to silence debates and silence free speech and name any concern, any dissenting voice as being a hater who utters hate speech.
Yes, I agree. I think basically there's a kind of a fragility, an emotional fragility to people when they enter the public square, where there's this notion that when we engage in public debate, that I should not be personally offended by what is said in the public square. And for example, if you criticize my way of life or my fundamental life choices, I take that as an assault, a personal attack, and I consider it to be uncivil and even worthy of legal punishment. And I think this indicates that there is a loss of realism about what political discourse actually entails, in the sense that political discourse will be contentious very often, and it will be offensive to some people because we're different and we have different opinions. And so if there was one thing that I think is behind this movement towards hate speech, it's a refusal to accept that we are a diverse society, that there is diversity and pluralism, and that people will disagree in a very robust manner. There's a kind of a blindness to that, or turning away from vibrant difference, diversity and opposition, and this kind of myth that we can just have this perfect harmony. It's just an ideological construct.
I would agree with that as well. I would add that this sort of emotional fragility you mentioned, I think is, it comes from this sort of loss of a communal feeling that we have as well, because when you have a community, the community in many ways comes first, not always, but often. But since the loss of community, since it's through the decline of religion and decline of patriotic feeling and so on, we have a certain loss of community. Only, as I said before, only what the individual himself or herself feels matters. And this sort of communal culture is replaced by an honor culture, where the slightest perceived insult is taken as the end all and be all of social behavior. And I sort of see, when we think of honor culture, we sort of think of medieval knights and such things. And that was a time, generalizing now, of course, but that was a time when communal feeling itself was very weak. It was a time before modern nation states had arisen and when culture was very atomized. And we sort of had a very individualistic, in certain ways, a certain individualistic honor culture then among certain classes. And we're sort of reversing to that now through the collapse of community. Once again, the individual becomes the only social unit that's worth preserving, and that leads to the importance of one's own individual emotions. I would maybe also add that when you speak of a diverse society, of course, there is, that's true, that there is this refusal to accept that we are indeed in a diverse society. On the other hand, it's a double-edged sword, I would say, because it is, in turn, the diverse society or the hyper-diverse society that has led to a certain loss of communal feeling. And so it sort of, it becomes a feedback loop, if you will, in which the fact that we are so diverse leads to the fact that we cannot unify around a certain set of ideas or principles. And that in itself then, of course, is going to contribute to the inability to have a communal feeling. And so the emotions of the individual become paramount.
Yes, and I think that the erosion of group life and the sort of transformation of group life, in particular its instrumentalization to politics, has played an important role in that, because what we understand as sort of the importance of the group and the association nowadays very often becomes a kind of political cause that has to be pled before the state. And so, in other words, how we express and honor our particular community or group ends up playing out in the courts of law and ends up playing out in the court of public opinion. In the sense, each group wants to vindicate its value and its worth before the court of public opinion and to litigate its worth in the courts. I'm not saying all groups do this, but I think part of the spectacle that we see unfolding in our public culture of constant conflict and polarization has to do with the fact that groups cannot find their meaning and worth simply getting on with their social practices. They seem to have a need for very robust form of public recognition by the state and by the people at large, which in a way ends up negating the fact of diversity and pluralism, because it tries to convert a national people into the community in a way that is simply not possible. The kind of community they're looking for can only be constituted at a local level. And if you try to constitute it at a national level, you end up with national socialism in Germany, or you end up with crazy forms of populism nowadays. Certain forms of populism. Yeah,
exactly. That is the feedback loop. So diversity is its own worst enemy, I think. And because, again, it leads to this sort of neo-tribalism where the sense of a nation state or of a religious community, where people have, of course, individual differences, but where there is at least a basic set of principles, either religious principles or patriotic principles upon which people agree, all get thrown by the wayside. And we have this sort of, instead of having one sort of large national tribe, if you will, for lack of a better word, we have a bunch of tribelets coexisting right next to each other in the same space, which as we can see, leads to a lot of trouble.
I have to ask some questions here, because I think that methodologically speaking, it would be an interesting thing. One of the issues that takes place when people talk about the notion of equality, for instance, is that they do not qualify what kind of equality they're talking about. It seems to me that the same abstract approach towards the concept of equality is an approach that towards the concept of diversity, because we need to ask, diversity of what? It seems to me that this is an important question that I don't hear discussed often. Because, for instance, a lot of the times, a lot of people that now claim diversity is not our strength, and in some cases I think that this is entirely correct, they are the people who would also say that a lot of the, you could say, utopian dreams of some people in the past were actually nightmares, because they were trying to impose upon people a kind of homogeneity that stifled completely any kind of individualism and individuality. So it seems to me that one of the important things that should take place in public discussion is to ask what kinds of diversity are compatible, no, excuse me, what kinds of diversity are desirable, and what other kinds of diversity are not. And what other kinds of diversity are actually corrosive for societies. But it is very difficult to have these conversations when we cannot reason with, we cannot meet each other in the public domain as reasoners, but we constantly have to do with the protected sentimentality of some people by some other, let's say, within quotation marks, aspiring emancipators of them. So it seems to me that this is one important discussion that is not had. Because, for instance, if we think of the political liberalism of John Rawls was implying, at least from my reading, that you cannot have a society where you have many sides trying to enforce their comprehensive moral doctrines. So clearly, there are some kind of divergences of opinion for roles, for instance, that are incompatible with a vibrant and well-functioning society. So it seems to me that this is something like an elephant in the room, that the slogan, diversity is our strength, does not show the problem with. What do you think of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that that there are different ways to understand diversity, and that it's a good exercise to make explicit what we're talking about when we use this word diversity. You mentioned John Rawls, and in my view, Rawls's conception of diversity is rather individualistic, because I think he understands diversity as differing comprehensive doctrines or differing views of the world that different people might have. And it seems to me that diversity is much more profound than that, because it's not really just about different opinions about the world or different conceptions of the universe. Diversity is actually different ways of life,
yeah,
and different ways of ordering public goods that you get across different communities and different associations. So I think that if we put the life of groups, if we put that in the foreground and understand that individuals actually derive meaning in their life from participation in group life, then when we talk about diversity, we really must keep in mind that we're talking about different expressions of group life, not just different, different individual opinions, but we're talking about different expressions of group life. So for example, in a Muslim community, women may wear a veil, and they may have, a role in their community that is very different than the role of men. Men may have more leadership roles in their community, or may have a more public role in their community. Now, when you're confronted with an Islamic community, just I'm giving it as a specific concrete example, and then you might have, say, a more progressive, let's say, self-professively progressive community, which is egalitarian in the way they understand gender roles. And in that community, they believe that it's, you know, it's just unacceptable for women to be expected to wear a veil in public, or for women to have subordinate roles that are like less important in the public square. So when those two communities meet, there's really no way to philosophically resolve all their difference. You know, you just have to find a modus vivendi. You have to find a way in which they can somehow coexist in the same space.
And this is the issue with multiculturalism, that there are all sorts of concrete questions that are not being asked about what is compatible with what else.
Yeah, and I think this goes into a thought I had in mind actually going into this discussion, which is that, you mentioned Rawls, and I think there is a long tradition of philosophers, I would say Kant is the same way, for example, in this particular case, of how there's this sort of naive feeling that if we all sort of got together and in all of our diversity, we would nonetheless all agree ultimately through education and so on that Western liberal democracy is the best there is. They don't maybe say it explicitly like that, but that sort of spirit that surely this is what we all think permeates the entire tradition, I think, of liberalism from Kant onwards. And of course, this is not the case. We see that there are systems of living that are completely incompatible to one another. And in spite of liberalism's best efforts, there are certain things, there are certain ways of life that cannot be understood. There is the very naive understanding of diversity, since we're talking about the meaning of that word, on the part of a lot of Western leaders, like Justin Trudeau comes to mind, for example, that diversity really means different kinds of food and different holidays and so on, different types of dress, being a devout Muslim, for example, would just mean that one fasts on the Ramadan and wears a veil and so on. But of course, different cultures are much more deep-seated than that, and it influences what we think about the world, it influences what we think about the society in which we live, what we think about the other tribelets within our society. And so understanding that there are limits to diversity in that way is very important.
Let me ask both of you, how should we go about understanding culture? And how is emotion, action, and possibly institutions related to it and the community that you mentioned before? I accept this is a sort of an abstract, difficult question, but I think that we touched upon it before, and I think it is incredibly important to get to be very meticulous about it so that we can understand exactly the importance of local community for our sentimentality.
Yeah, I think culture is everything, and that goes back to the sort of Western naivete that reduces culture to sort of external things. They tend to think that culture is a question of eating with chopsticks instead of a knife and fork, for example. Very superficial things, because we ourselves, as we mentioned before, we ourselves, or at least as I mentioned before, we've become sort of detached from our past. Well, you, David, you also said the expression of standing on the shoulders of giants. We've sort of forgotten that. When we no longer know what came before us, we no longer know all of the things that a culture implies. And that leads to this naivete where we think that culture is just a series of external signs. We need to understand that culture is all-encompassing, really, and it includes, it runs the gamut from various ways of dress and various ways of eating, for example, to different belief systems, including systems that bleed into the political sphere, what we think is politically acceptable or not. And when we understand that all of those things are involved in culture, then multiculturalism, of course, becomes much more problematic, because we realize that that's going to have a very concrete effect on how we organize our state.
I would say that, I agree with all that was just said, but I also would say that my understanding of culture is, I remember reading a little bit about Bildung, the concept of Bildung in German, and basically this idea, Humboldt, for example, is one of the people who talked about culture in that sense, and as building up the person. It's a way in which we shape our personality. So I would say culture is the factors that shape human personality, and that can be decisive or highly influential in the development of human personality. And by human personality, I mean how we understand the world, how we understand ourselves in the world, but also, I would say also what we desire, what we aspire to, what we hope for. So it's both desire and knowledge, and how those are channeled, for me, is culture. So you go to McDonald's and you eat at McDonald's, okay? It's not high culture. But it is part of that sense of culture, in the sense that if you go every day to eat at McDonald's, that will shape how you understand food, how you understand eating with others, being at a table. All of that will be shaped by, you know, your everyday, your social structures, your economic structures.
And how would you say that some patterns of emotions and actions relate to it? Because you could definitely say that when we are talking about food culture, we are talking about the kinds of actions that people perform when they are preparing food, when they're cooking it, when they eat it, and the way in which all this is integrated within their daily lives. So what is the importance of emotions and for culture? Because it seems to me that whenever we are talking about cultures and we try to be a bit more specific, there is an element of emotionality going into it. For instance, we could say the level of a kind of feeling of national pride, or a kind of feeling of identification with a particular local community, and the tendency to feel a sort of increased solidarity with members of these groups.
I mean, I'll just say on that, and then I'll hand it over, just to say that I think that presenting beauty to people can shape their emotional life and their desires, how they perceive what is beautiful and what is attractive. And that depends on their upbringing, because children are highly imitative. And, you know, I just have the example of my daughter, who's 15 months old. You know, if she won't eat her food, I take a piece of her food and I eat it and I pretend that I love it. And it doesn't matter how, even if I hate it, I just say, oh, yum, 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 and I eat it, and then she wants it.
Yeah.
And there is that sense in which children, but also adults, when they see their peers loving something, wanting something, liking something, they will start to see it as an object of desire and an object of, you know, admiration. And teenagers, obviously, this happens hugely among teenagers. I'm not saying that we're only shaped by what other people want. But I would say that's a socialization. It's part of socialization, is where we're given cues about what we should aspire to. And I'm not a determinist. I don't think that society fully determines our desires. But I think when we talk about culture, it is true that society and social behavior does influence the way we our emotions work and what we aspire to, desire, hope for, etc.
Right. Yeah, that's a good method. We used to get a box on the ear usually when we didn't eat our food. So that's I prefer your method. But the you mentioned the beauty. I think that's also it's very important. I think also part of education. I guess it's a common theme, but we don't understand the beauty that has come before us, and that has everyone sort of establishes his own or her own sense of beauty, and lacking a sense of communal beauty is very detrimental. Having no aesthetic communal sense is very bad for community, because one should be unified more or less. I mean, of course, again, there's room for individual differences, but around certain ideas of architecture and literature and so on, and art, and multiculturalism creates a sort of hodgepodge of competing aesthetic claims, which is not always a bad thing. Of course, obviously, all cultures have produced beauty in their own way, but it does lead to this sort of hodgepodge goes hand in hand with the hyper-individualism we have, in which everything is accorded the same time and respect, which in an abstract sense is not necessarily a bad thing, but as a member of a particular time and place, there are certain things that should be emphasized above others. And then of course one can go beyond those and learn about other aesthetic traditions as well. But that as well, I think is a hallmark of how we have sort of lost our way.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.